Well, welcome to the Cloud Computing Show, episode number 39. We are almost live here at VMware, hidden away in the Press and Analyst Center. And I have got a great group of friends and industry colleagues. Let me do the introductions before we get started. Vanessa Alvarez, an industry analyst with Frost and Sullivan. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Great. So glad you could join us all the way from Boston. And some of the regular gang, we have Brian Bukowski, the CEO of Citrus Leaf. Hey, Brian.
Hi, Gary.
Hello. Adrian Cole, back after a short hiatus, the founder of JClouds.
Oh, hi.
And James Waters, the senior manager of vCloud Solutions at VMware. We'll have a lot to talk about from James today. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Gary.
It is, so we're here right after the opening of the VMware show, VMworld. A few of us were down on the trade show floor. Vanessa, what did you think?
I think cloud is happening, right? I think it's really about enterprises today trying to figure out just where their cloud strategy needs to be, right? And really trying to understand what partners, what vendors they are, need to work with.
Yeah. I mean, it is crazy down there in terms of the number of companies, the size of the booths. I mean,
I tried to walk around with a friend, Christopher Hoff, and we were just trying to have small talk and walk the floor. And it was literally impossible because immediately it'd be like, you separated, the crowd would push you one way or the other. You can't even walk down there. And I think the level of success that they're at right now is starting to become a fire code issue.
But kudos to VMware, I mean, for being able to get so many people together and so much excitement. I mean, there really was a buzz.
12,000 last year, they said. 16.
I heard 16 somewhere this year.
And those are paid. I'll just tell you, I've tried to get people free tickets, like ISV partners.
It doesn't happen.
Those are paid 16,000 people.
Yeah, and real customers with real budgets and real problems.
$1,700 a pop to walk the floor.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, if someone's willing to spend $1,700 to come here, they have a strategy in place, and they're here to determine who they need to be looking at.
Yeah, definitely. So in many ways, this show, I think, is the culmination of the summer of cloud stacks. I think it got kicked off in some respects with OpenStack, which happened around OSCON mid-July. Adrian, you were up there at that show, right?
Yeah. Yep. That was in Austin. Was the inaugural event for that. It was a week with maybe 150 or 200 folks that were involved in planning the, you know, what would become the kickoff for the OpenStack. And if you follow a lot of this stuff on the open source spaces, it's still going pretty strong.
Right.
That's a real big part of it.
Right. And then over the course of the summer, we had, of course, on the show, we had Cloud.com and Eucalyptus very recently, two other players who have their own cloud stacks. Of course, Amazon has been around for a while. You can't buy their cloud stack if you wanted to, so we should put that in a somewhat different category.
Do they realize that's a mistake yet?
Everybody else allows you to buy the cloud stack, and they don't, so we'll see what happens. Nimbula just got some funding, ex-EC2 guys, so they might have their own cloud stack. Joyent has a stack. Microsoft, of course, has their stack with Azure, and that'll be great for Windows customers. And of course, now we have the general availability of the VMware vCloud Director.
Correct.
I got it correct, James. You are an employee of VMware, but since you know the most about it, why don't you just give us a little up-to-date overview of what has actually happened with the VMware vCloud Director?
Yeah, it's the product that we've been waiting to launch now for, you know, pretty much all summer. I've been kind of in hush-hush mode. I can't talk about it.
I think we heard a couple of "I can't talk about it" over the course of the summer, too.
Yeah, and it sucked. Because you want to be out there engaging with what you know about the future of cloud and what you can engineer and what you can do. And Adrian and I were just on a panel about, you know, kind of application deployment with vCloud 1.0, which is instantiated by vCloud Director. And the big thing, the biggest difference, and this is said well by George Reese, is it's compatible with existing data center architectures. So you can bring a traditional firewalling layer 2 kind of connectivity scheme where you can broadcast and firewall and isolate in a network sense. It uses anything that works on vSphere in terms of formatting, so OVF, vApps works on it.
We might need to have a glossary with the show, too.
There are a lot of TLAs in it, three-letter acronyms. I mean, there's and some four-letter ones. it does a lot.
FLA.
FLA, four-letter acronyms. Yeah. What do you do with five then? So I think the big thing that this squares off is a play between enterprise compatibility plus convenience as the future of cloud, and kind of more of this disposable, you know, you don't know where your resource is or what it's doing, but it's on a network somewhere and pinging back to you kind of cloud.
Right. Which today is most epitomized by Amazon as the market leader.
Yeah,
we can just use that as an example.
On high scale web applications and data processing applications. But, you know, outside of that, the enterprise context that we have haven't moved a lot of traditional applications there. And so I think this, you know, if cloud really has legs, and I believe it does, it's really going to be a big opening of the gates for more kinds of applications that can be moved to a kind of convenient cloud deployment framework.
If we include everybody that I mentioned in that roundup list before, there's something like 8 cloud stacks which all claim to be the infrastructure of choice, at least from each of those vendors, right? Each of those vendors saying this is the infrastructure of choice for deploying cloud infrastructure. What happens now? I mean, do we need all of these stacks? How do developers who are doing things, I mean, Brian, you're working with customers to deploy things sometimes on these cloud stacks, sometimes elsewhere. What's your thought on, you know, how many do we need and how does this shake out over the next year or so?
Most of my customers are running private data centers with cloud methodologies. So they're still in the land of Puppet Chef, which is even further epitomizes, I would say, the do whatever you like. You don't have any guarantees. You don't know where your resources are, but at least allows them a certain amount of flexibility and automation. So that's what a lot of what I'm seeing with a few customers starting to move towards EC2. EC2 is the only thing they know because, you know, that's what they've been told to look at. So a lot of people are still stuck with their own data centers at this point, and I think that there's going to be a huge shakeout over the coming year.
Adrian, as a guy who spent a lot of time looking at the API side of this equation across multiple cloud stacks, what happens over the next year or so?
Well, there's two fights going on. At least one is the platform fight, and the other one's the infrastructure as a service fight. And there are plenty of options in the infrastructure as a service fight that would be very comparable, whereas in the platform level, they aren't as much. So, for example, you have folks running like CloudEnt, and there aren't a lot of folks running like Couch as a service. Whereas, even if there are differences in the offerings, there are some core similarities between like the OpenStack and the Nimbula and all those other guys. And so, I think at the end of the day, we have a heating brawl between the infrastructure folks, and then this space where we will probably have a similar fight next year or the year after in the platform area.
And is it just we haven't gotten there yet? And
as far as the, you know, the players, it's, you know, with Nimbula especially, you know, looking at what they have to offer, they're looking at, you know, giving the same expertise as the EC2. Like, for example, there are other EC2 founders that went off and like worked at Opscode for the Chef stuff. But this is literally those folks going into offering a competing service that you could install, which is not something Amazon had poised themselves to do.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, they're sort of a surprise.
Yeah.
Where some of the other initiatives, like people saw the vCloud train coming. And so that wasn't a surprise that, like, you know, this week we have 16,000 people here, you know, interested in VMware technologies, including vCloud. Who knows if there's another one lying in wait? There's already enough good options now to make it a hard decision.
Let me ask you this question. I'm going to call this a little bit of a proliferation of stacks. Is the volume in the number of stacks making it easier for new people to come in because things are getting more standardized and there's some commonalities across the API, or is it just getting harder because there's so much noise and so much confusion? Does the question make sense?
The question makes a lot of sense. I mean, right now, the standardization isn't really happening that much because there are folks who are adopting, for the sake of convenience, existing APIs like EC2, but like Nimbula has a different API than that, and they could have very well used the EC2 API. You know, one might expect a Google infrastructure service, which hasn't been formally announced, to use an EC2 type API, but who knows?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as far as it goes with all the rest of them, For example, the vCloud API was just finalized now. So there's no player that, except for VMware, that could actually implement it as it's in its final state.
Right.
So what I'd say is that it doesn't actually bring us closer to standardization. It's still broadening and fanning out. And OpenStack may help with that. But even OpenStack is a convergence of two different cloud products, the one that Rackspace had written,
right,
and the one that the Nova CC NASA guys had written, which, while the Nova CC one had the EC2 API, obviously the Rackspace one didn't. So from an API perspective, that isn't necessarily solved. One thing I hope is that you would end up with vendors that support multiple ones, and you could choose one that you like out of the mix.
Mm. I just wanted to add one thing to that. You know, I think it's not really a question of whether it's going to shake out. I think we're going to have a number of different, perspectives of different clouds, and I think they're each going to differentiate themselves in individual manner, right? So they're going to offer a particular feature or functionality to differentiate themselves, and that's going to work for one particular enterprise, maybe not for another, right? I think each enterprise has individual unique needs, and I think at the end of the day, they're really looking for something that is going to fit those needs, and whether that be a Eucalyptus cloud or whether it be a vCloud, it's going to depend on what their needs are.
What I see is that a lot of companies are looking for something above the API layer. So the real question is how the tools that are going to be built on top of these APIs, they're going to make things even easier, be they simpler scripting systems, be they JClouds, be they this or that. Some of it's going to be API-based for some of those. Some of it's going to be, GUI-based, where you've got a nice web page and you can say, I want, this and that, and set up this policy and that policy. I think the work becomes harder for some of those GUI providers and tool providers that may have to support several APIs in the transition. Most customers, so the API, the GUI providers that succeed will probably be those that are flexibly and easily able to support a greater set of APIs in the future.
CTO of OpsCode tweeted during a big fight about APIs. He's like, guys, calm down. He's like, it takes us one day to add support for a new API. If it matters, we'll add it.
To add support for a new cloud stack.
A new cloud stack, essentially. I mean, so I think that where people come from the API land is they think about, like, the Windows application APIs and registries and all the shit that locked you in permanently, right? Like, really locked you in. But
right.
Management APIs have yet to be proven to me to be a problem.
Yeah, but I just want to play devil's advocate with you for a second. I mean, it's one thing to, quote-unquote, implement the API. It's another thing to then, be using it in production for a suite of applications.
It's the thing everyone talks about the API, because when you talk about an API, it's like there's two different ways of describing doing the same thing. You can imagine that that's the fight. That has nothing to do with it. It has everything to do with the feature. So, for instance, you might have the same API between Amazon and vCloud, but vCloud has a vApp.
Mm-hmm.
Amazon doesn't.
Right.
And that's what matters.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how you describe the feature. What matters is the feature.
There's a very small population of people who would get pissed off about APIs being incompatible, and they would solve those problems in a week. And that's, I think, what you're kind of getting at. People really aren't locking. I mean, they are. In some cases, they literally are locking themselves in. But I think Randy Bias also mentions this as it's more the architecture you lock into than an API you lock into. And it's another way of saying the same thing, where if you buy in and it ends up, when I look at it, you end up boiling down to either service levels that you can get from one provider versus another, or features.
Mm-hmm.
like platforms. A lot of times it's platform features. Mm-hmm. So they aren't, it's this mixing and matching where you kind of like maybe realize, maybe didn't realize where these lines start
right.
and stop. I think that, there are some tools that people are working on. For example, one thing I'll talk about later is this thing where, but you have tools that can build the services underneath of an API.
Give us an example there.
So for example, actually there's even a newer Apache project on the same thing, but there's a Google App Engine have a set of APIs that you literally code to access things like Memcached.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And so these APIs are what you're binding to. So they could be a SaaS or they could be something built up to. And in this case, if an alternate service can build up to that, you're fine. But if it is a fairly niche service, then you're really getting to a point where it's like, you're giving people very few choices.
Yeah.
Today, it's really hard because it's hard to build a portable service underneath an API that someone hasn't even defined yet. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if one area of folks call this like the data API, it looks sort of like Memcached or something like that, then it's very hard to like go to any cloud and achieve that. Even with tools like Chef, because it's not necessarily building the infrastructure, it's really welding that to an API. And so people are binding themselves to less and less mature APIs. They haven't been vetted by big parties, and they're still putting them in their applications. And I think that has a lot of gravity. It does with today's agile infrastructure. I think that it doesn't necessarily make it impossible for them to move off.
Right.
But that's a big deal. And then from an infrastructure standpoint, it's, you know, when I focus on the platform side, but it's also true in infrastructure components such as storage. And you know, when you get to a point where you have really designed your app that it can only work with this specific storage architecture in place, then even if that's not a platform service, it's equally binding.
So the advice there is, you know, even though you might have to pick an API to get your application running, try to stay abstract about it, or try to stay as, you know, don't get too ingratiated, too specific. I mean, what's the advice to a developer who wants to build a cloud application?
I think just do a little bit of homework. Like one thing I would say, like I sometimes kind of make fun of some open source projects because it's like they did all of 3 minutes homework to see what was out there before they launched a new project. And it's like, you know, just do a little bit more. Even if you don't like what's out there, just look. I mean, it's not in today's internet age, it's not that hard. And the same thing goes for, you know, cloud stuff. Even though every conference I go to, I get some dude that comes up and says, "Where's the one page that has all the API information on it?" And I'm sorry, dude, that doesn't exist. But that doesn't mean that you can't do a simple web search and like follow folks like are here today and ask questions.
Right.
And
or use the lazy web.
Yeah, yes. Lazy web. Right. So it will cost you a little bit of research time, but you know, you can then make an informed decision where I am knowingly binding myself to this feature, and I know what the impact of that is.
Right.
Usually,
go ahead, Brian.
Usually in those cases, and this is the way you approach any project, I believe, mm-hmm. when you have a proliferation of APIs, you can find the core subset that keeps you out of trouble in the future.
Uh-huh.
So that's the advice that I would give to someone working these APIs. A great example, since you mentioned Memcached, is if you were to simply read the Redis documentation, it has a bunch of crazy little features that look kind of cool. And you could embed yourself to the Redis server in specific, or you could keep to a more general purpose API, stick yourself to something that's much more Memcache-like, and then allow yourself the ability to switch from server implementation to server implementation. If you do that little bit of homework, find the common set, because the models just aren't that different, as per James' point.
Yeah, and I've talked to people who say they, you know, they have a primary site on Amazon, secondary site on Rackspace, but they only use features that are common to both.
And Tom Moriani from EngineYard said that a year ago at Cloud Club. He's like, "I just won't use the stuff that's not common
yeah.
to many people."
Yeah.
To some extent, there has to be some kind of simulation.
Right.
But
so,
I'd like to
ahead.
Raise a meta issue here.
Okay,
I got into,
well, we like meta issues.
The mother of all kind of Twitter arguments with Simon Wardley about this, about the OpenStack API.
Okay.
And I think he misrepresented to some extent my real question, which was, is there still innovation happening in terms of features? And so I think the people that want everyone to just take the EC2 API and shut up, they're kind of in the camp of, look, it is what it is, just write your app to it and shut up. And then there's this other camp out there that I'm a part of that says there's still lots of room to innovate, that we're in a very early era of all of this. And you wouldn't see 15 companies starting up if it wasn't a space where you could still innovate.
Right.
It just wouldn't happen. VCs are not that stupid. They can read markets and they can see how tightly coupled the buying behavior is to a dominant design.
Right.
They're very good at that. And so I would say that that's the important meta issue here, is that people are still trying to figure out what features and for what buyer. And I think it's time for a little bit more of who are you solving a problem for to come into
right.
the cloud discussion.
So that's the question I wanted to ask to the group. Well, how quickly do we get these various cloud stacks, or how quickly do these cloud stacks get to become known for specialization in certain areas? For example, people say that, you know, OpenStack is forever going to be focused more on the service provider side just because of the Rackspace heritage and involvement. That, you know, may or may not be the case, but I've heard that mentioned before. The VMware stack is, in my opinion, going to have much more favorable advantage when coupled with enterprise solutions. I mean, how quickly does that happen, or is it going to take some more time? Any thoughts there?
Well, I know that Cloud Director is absolutely aimed at being an extensible part of an enterprise data center and doing it in a seamless way with all the fun scalability and elasticity of cloud. So I think VMware certainly made its bet with the largest POs in the world.
But there's a lot of space there. And the one thing that I'd say is that there will be various ways of getting 10-year-old IT under an API. And then what you get to is that, when people start looking at seriously, it's especially enterprises going in, they all have various concerns. Like I sat next to some folks that are in the post-production crowd, and they're like, we have all of these, concerns about the reliability of latency. Mm-hmm. Like I just want it to be the same.
Right.
So I think there's all sorts of problems to be solved, and I think to a certain degree it's getting people in the water so that they know what's there.
Right. Well, we saw that a little bit with Amazon doing the high performance subsegment of the cloud, right? I mean, there's a thing
which all of their apologists said would never happen because you just write to what is there. They always said it was good enough and don't worry about it. And they were wrong. Even Amazon said, "Oh, we're going to have something specialized."
So is that the next wave? Is this, mass customization and specialization of different
stacks
that are...
It's a dynamic strategic tension, right? It's a dynamic
I understand. Yeah, so, I mean, it's hard. We want to just take a look and sort of see where the guiding lights are going
to
be.
And I think IBM has kind of moved down the route of really trying to specialize their clouds. And I know that they're really not, the poster child of a cloud, but they do talk about the specialized cloud and how it's going to fit each vertical, right? Each vertical is going to require a different feature and function.
Their whole sales force is vertically aligned. I mean, that makes total sense. They have vertical sales teams. That's all of IBM is run on verticals.
Well, and I think that to some extent, in any cloud solution, what should happen is it should be customized to some extent in terms of functionality, right? Because what one enterprise may need in terms of, high performance, maybe another enterprise won't need that much high performance, but they'll need superior quality of service or superior security and management. So I think that when you look at different verticals, you really have to understand what their needs are and be able to customize to some extent that solution. So standardize to customize. And I know that's probably a paradox, but it's just, I think to some extent, some components need to be standardized, and then you can customize off of that. So there's some commonality between all clouds.
I think we have a history of wanting to standardize things because we couldn't do it whatever we were doing unless they were standardized, and I think today we've shown that we can deal with this craziness that exists in the cloud without
having that
hours
standardization
of evening time from some cloud hackers, right? And I mean, I think that there is a difference today with the agile movement. I think that the services offered, I'm still I was bragging about the cluster computing just instances, but I'm sure there's plenty of people that are completely unimpressed because they're still I'm sure Brian's card in front of me is still much more impressive than the cluster computing instance. I mean, so it's still when do we get out of catching up with years old IT and actually move significantly further?
Right.
And it should be a position where a select few could actually deliver a service like that, not I can go computer shop with that.
Right. Well, it's different than, I spent a lot of time in the networking world earlier on with protocols, and protocols go through this very lengthy process for standardization. And, it can take years and years and years before, decades before one device can talk to the other. And so we are in a different era where it's not quite the same level of requirements, and as you mentioned, by people doing clever tricks and tips with APIs, we can get around a lot of those things in a matter of hours or days, not years or decades. So it really is different from that perspective.
So my fear right now is that never can I remember in history has there been a successful quality of service API. back in the mid-90s, there were a lot of attempts in networking, since you brought up networking, Gary.
Right. Like ATM and things like
well,
that? Or
ATM, you could never specify end-to-end what the quality of service was. You couldn't at the application. There were some attempts.
Okay.
But no one ever successfully wrote the API at the application developer level that said, hi, I'm a streaming service, I'm this, even though Cisco writes a bunch of red-black prioritization, and then ATM has a whole bunch of theirs, and there's, I can't remember all the acronyms, RTSP and all these different systems to overlay quality of service on unreliable networks. And the specification of quality of service ends up being kind of dicey, exactly how you say it. So the world where we were positing, all of the APIs are easy to map into each other, and the fundamental paradigms were all simple, and one is the other one. QoS has never yet reached the point where the specification of quality of service, latency, loss could ever really be mapped one to the other. Maybe now is the time. Maybe
right.
Finally a QoS API really takes off that rides up to the API level, the application level, where it can be used. But history's against it, and I'm a little concerned.
Yeah. I think I talked a couple of shows ago about MPLS, which I was hearing a lot about,
yeah.
You know, from the AT&T guys who were all over the structure conference a while back and saying that this is the way to solve all these problems by having this guaranteed end-to-end delivery. But I don't think your average enterprise is going to want to sign up for an MPLS-enabled network and is rather going to want to sign up for, you know, one of the cloud stacks that we're talking about here.
Well, you know, the service provider does have, you know, a lot of influence in the enterprise space. And when enterprises look at recommendations, and, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, they are looking at the AT&Ts and the Verizons of the world. So I think that, to your point, I think they are in a position to provide that QoS. I think they need to think about it a different way.
Right, but not necessarily at the... You're not talking about providing it at the network level,
correct.
Brian. You're talking about providing it at a higher level where the application can make choices.
When I'm an enterprise and I'm clicking on my databases and I want one to be faster and one to be slower, how that jams into the network and to all the storage pieces, and, you know, I want this disk to be attached via this mechanism, and this one can't just be iSCSI, and if it is iSCSI, then it has to be, you know,
that's
blah,
policy.
Blah, blah, blah.
I mean, that's essentially QoS policy. I mean,
exactly. So
that's
this policy specification has to be well defined and has to be similar from stack to stack. Otherwise, you'll never be able to specify policy.
I think policy is actually going to be everything I'm hearing whispers out of the enterprise is help us with policy.
Policy management.
Yeah. I saw a data sheet on an enterprise that talked about, hey, we're going to go deploy Microsoft SQL. It has to have all of these security checks.
Yeah.
The networks have to look like this. The IO has to look like this. All of these things have to look like that. And that's why I'm a really big fan of some of what VMware is doing with its cloud products, because it's building in the constructs that allow you to later attach policy. And I think that the mistake that kind of pure commodity plays make is that you can just write all that into the app and that the app doesn't need anything from the substrate in terms of guaranteeing that policy. So I think those are the two opposing views, is that you ask the substrate for anything, or do you just make the app always sort of fuzzy logic thinking on its feet how to get QoS?
And even in the mid-90s, the people who, like me, were trying to do video service and deal with video editing systems, who wanted, at the application level, to let a substrate take care of it, there was way too much fragmentation throughout that period. So even though there were APIs here and there, they never gelled, and APIs were left to fend for themselves. So I hope that world doesn't happen, and that policy will be allowed to go up, to propagate between these two layers. I think it needs to happen, and I look forward to the work on it.
I think that's absolutely the thing I spend my personal time thinking about is, you know, the idea that you just write everything into the app, that, like, there's supposed to be these genius app developers out there, right, that there's like, oh, we'll just do everything in the app and nothing in the substrate. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a lot to process. I mean, you have to talk about the time that you want to take to think about all those pieces, right? And do you actually want the application developer to be thinking about all those pieces?
Yeah.
Or to know that.
But if all the different cloud stacks use different ways of specifying all those different policy, it's almost worse. That's what happened before. And I hope that we
I don't think that many cloud stacks will be successful. If you look at the book called The Mastery of the Dynamics of Innovation, they show continuous chart after chart, tons in the beginning, dominant design,
right.
Three left at the end.
Three left at the end.
Well,
yeah.
I hope you're right this time.
Who will be the three? We don't know yet.
I think one thing is that, like, policy as attacked as an individual issue. And folks who specialize in rules engines and how they work and how to do that, and dealing with how do you mitigate some of those issues, which probably aren't perfected, you know, that's a job by itself. And so, you know, for example, there's a startup called CloudBees who, you know, one of the founders there is like the guy who invented the Drools, which ended up being the JBoss Rules project, for that reason that, you know, automating platforms that use infrastructure requires you to have somebody who's an expert at rules. And what do you do when you know, instance pops out of the sky or this volume degrades or whatever, because that's a part of your business now. And you know, and I wonder, you know, if like the Agile team will increasingly have visibility into folks who specialize on policies, rules, engines, and how that relates to the app stack as like just as equals with the network and the DBA folks and the stuff. So.
Yeah. I want to go back to something earlier that we spoke about for just a second and then skipped on. In all these cloud stacks, we mentioned that everybody except Amazon, you can buy or acquire open source, whatever, the software, and have it to play with it locally, if you like. Amazon is the only one that isn't in that camp. And is that a tenable position for them to be long term? Will people like, you know, Eucalyptus just fill the gap by providing an EC2 compatible API for people who want to deploy locally and Amazon doesn't have to worry?
I pity the fool that just thinks Amazon will never do anything about this. You know, because the thing is that they're very smart and whatever software they're using behind the scenes is going to be very good. And if they're losing substantial, I mean, I'm not saying it's culturally the case currently that they would necessarily provide like shrink-wrapped OEM versions of the EC2 cloud. But what I mean to say is if it becomes a business decision,
right,
they would already have known all of the ways that various people are trying to clone their efforts, and at best, the ones that are cloning are cloning. And the ones that are not are competitors. Mm-hmm. And so either way, you know what the cloners are trying to do because you're the one they're following. And the other ones, you could essentially follow what they're doing because they're doing it in open source. So, I mean, I think either way, Amazon, I wouldn't call them out on this. Because, like, for example, one thing James rightly pointed out was that there were a lot of, like, you know, naysayers about Amazon, and then they came up with a relative surprise, like they do, and said, you know, bam, take this. And
you mean when they're saying complaints about the I/O traffic and then
right.
coming up with
and
a specific solution for it?
With server-to-server I/O, it didn't address server-to-storage I/O, just to be a nitpick. Because they still haven't solved server-to-storage I/O. I don't want to give them more credit.
For example, this thing is literally, it's called like a placement zone.
Right.
In EC2, there's this region concept, there's an availability concept, and they've introduced a smaller concept of this that's very simple right now, which just basically says group these things together. And I've had correspondence with some of the EC2 guys, and essentially they've alluded to this is like the very most basic implementation of, you know, version 0.1, and you will get very sophisticated ways of grouping technology together based on policy perhaps, but. You know, go figure, right?
Oh my God, I thought the Amazon EC2 API of 2007 was all we'd ever need to run any infrastructure ever signed globally.
Yeah.
I thought that was the truth. Oh wait, no one agrees with you.
At the end of the day, Amazon is a business. They're running a business, right? They're not going to leave money on the table. And if they feel that it's the right opportunity for them to go down a particular road, then they will.
Yeah.
But you have to talk about the development model. It's one thing to release a SaaS app. It's another thing to release production. Like, when you release vCloud Director, VMware vCloud Director, like, the Q&A cycle on it is intense, right? It's not like you just throw it over the wall and hope enterprises will just stand it up. It's a different approach to Q&A.
So, I mean, one thing I have to mention is that I just pour too much. But I also have to mention that I went to this, like, you know, Hadoop day over in Seattle, and essentially it was one big Elastic MapReduce love fest. And, you know, I spoke at length with, like, the GM of Elastic MapReduce, and then I'm thinking to myself, there's a GM of Elastic MapReduce?
At Amazon.
Yeah. And then there's some undisclosed several people that are working solely on MapReduce now, and it, like, you know, it vetted, it went through its incubator stage, and it's a real product, and you know, at no point in that conversation was there any hope for anyone to get EMR, you know, behind their firewall, not even a thread of hope. Through that discussion, it was like always a discussion. Well, how could we get you into this system? Could we put a VPN? Could we do this? Could we do that?
Oh, not about and bringing it locally.
Their whole thesis is that they can be a more efficient bookseller only now of compute nodes. They're going to be cheaper. Like, if you listen to their strategy, they can be cheaper.
Well, the idea, right? I mean, isn't that the premise of public clouds is that in aggregate, the public cloud provider will be able to do it cheaper than any individual enterprise could on their own?
That is a thesis. I would submit that there's a 16,000 not as price elastic buyers out there who could tolerate 10% more expense for control, and that that is the big play that Amazon's making. That in books, yes, if you have a cheaper book, I'll buy from you because it's the same book. In data centers, it's not quite the same thing.
It's not the same. It's not the same. Yeah, that's true. But
I mean, why are there so many startups doing this if it's like the outsource model is just like this home run? And no,
why are there so many startups doing what?
Well, doing
their own deployment or doing stuff on public clouds?
No. There's little web. Yeah, there's certainly web people out there, but I mean doing their own cloud stacks.
Oh, why are so many people doing their own cloud stacks?
If there was just unbelievable against.
Okay, so what you're saying is if the answer was public cloud, we wouldn't see so many stacks because Amazon has already delivered a great public cloud. An adequate public cloud for your...
Did you try to put that in my mouth?
That's the nature of a competitive landscape, though. I mean, clearly there's a market out there for Amazon, and obviously they're making a business out of it, right?
Yeah.
I think at the end of the day, if they feel that their customer base or if they can create more revenue out of adding much more features and functionality to their cloud, then they will.
Yeah.
It's not technologically impossible, right? Other people are doing it. They are just banking on, you know, this customer base that they have and that they continue to make money off of it.
So the concern that I have, I mean, what really bugs me about this whole, not the discussion, but the reality, is one problem, which is light speed. So the fact is that if I say, well, you know, some of my load is best done in Amazon, and some of my best load is done over here in vCloud. Some of my best load is done by renting two racks over in South Carolina. Then I have to deal with the problem of unreliable transport and everything we've been talking about in terms of the ability to reserve resources pretty much goes out the window. So Amazon's first mover advantage has to be countered with really great technological innovation by the other cloud systems and cloud providers, but it's still a network effect, and it's still on a network that if I have stuff over here, I'm not going to really want to mix and match unless there's a massive compelling advantage.
One thing I'm really excited about with vCloud is that because it's a software stack, it can be deployed probably in every major city in the country. So about a year from now, I'd expect that you can get a local metro area latency, you know, under 30 milliseconds of latency, cloud, you know, connectivity. So I think that will be a big advantage, that it will have a lot more local options.
I mean, well, one thing that we used to laugh about was this, like, you know, ship your hard drive to Amazon. Answer to getting things in S3.
Yeah,
but the funny thing is that actually people are using that.
Yeah.
And at the Hadoop Day thing, people were talking about, yeah, we really like the fact that they're using words like partner with Amazon. Like, you know, that we know that we can get our drives over there and we can, you know. So at the end of the day, like, if you do have, you know, partner-friendly clouds that do offer creative solutions to the data transportation problem.
I gotta say, Adrian, did you just step in the latency versus bandwidth problem, though? I mean, I think Brian was talking about latency and you're talking about bandwidth. So the classic thing is that a Volkswagen has full of tape, has the best bandwidth. But
or a 747 and a power dive.
Yeah, it has
it's
amazing
than
bandwidth,
all the networks on the
but it has it still has crap latency. So I said
that was not a valid discussion point for the latency.
They're both challenges and they're both going to be solved a bunch of different ways, and we certainly haven't seen the end of it. I mean, there was a lot of activity not too long ago about companies doing various types of TCP tricks and acceleration for enterprise to cloud data migration back and forth.
Yeah.
And yet, we haven't seen, in my opinion, any of those reach some level of success that trumps the ship the drive. That's still seems to be the dominant solution for that problem.
So I'll just put this out there that one other thing that we're going to announce tomorrow is vCloud Data Center, which is pretty exciting. We had vCloud Express, which was our developer-focused and web application-focused pay-per-use model. Tomorrow they're coming out with vCloud Data Center. One of the lead sponsors and huge investors in vCloud Data Center as a service is Verizon, who has a lot of MPLS customers.
Mm-hmm.
So to put context here, they have a lot of existing MPLS customers, and now they'll be able to terminate all that MPLS to a public cloud.
Are you going
to
be promoting MPLS as well?
I am not taking sides in network protocols, Gary. All I'm saying is that this will be a player, and that the market will prove out what the demand for this is, and people who have that will have access to a cloud resource.
Okay. Did you have a comment, Vanessa?
No.
Oh. So here's what I want. I want to get, for anybody who has a comment, sort of something that you're looking forward to at the show, hoping to see, company, trend, any general thoughts, and then we'll jump into to cloud tips before we wrap things up. So any... Vanessa, you came all the way from Boston. What's on your hit list for this show?
I really just want to see a lot of customer panel sessions, right? I want to see customers really doing this and really implementing vCloud and really looking at vCloud Director as a solution for them. And so I'm looking forward to hearing that and looking at the different vendors and hearing their customers as well.
I'm looking for the, last year, VMware, when they were talking about vCloud, there was a few partners unveiled out of the thousands network that might potentially deliver vCloud solutions. And so here we are a year later. I'm really looking to kind of go around again and talk to the various folks and see who now are popping onto the map. Because I think we all know Terramark, for example, very good
right.
Supporters of vCloud and so are BlueLock. And, but there are certainly others, and I would like to see what their culture is as far as, what makes them tick, what they like to present as options when we talk about these unique service feature and mesh, and see what that means to people.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to today. When you walk into the lounge, the solutions lounge at VMworld here, it is 10 or 15 of the biggest names and the biggest companies in IT and infrastructure. And then when you get beyond that into the sides, you get to the little startup cities and so forth. And that's always the fun part to see is what ecosystem is bubbling up. I mean, the companies that are in the front now have big budgets, big needs. They've got to hit revenue goals, fill in pieces of the infrastructure. So I'm curious, what are the smaller companies that are going to emerge to fill any gaps there? That's what I'm going to spend my time on tomorrow. Anything else?
Well, I brought for show and tell here today.
Oh, we almost forgot about it.
Yay, show and tell.
Show and tell on the radio, as they say. A Fusion I.O. card, for those of you who have been living under a rock, Fusion I.O. has been shipping some excellent enterprise-quality flash storage. The purpose of their company is to speed up database access primarily, but it can be used for a number of storage purposes. And one of my gripes against cloud deployments in particular over the last few years is that very few have jumped on the SSD flash bandwagon. This particular card I have in front of me is about the size of your outstretched hand, costs $14,000, holds 640 gigabytes, but would replace, in terms of IOs, over 4,000 hard drives. 4,000. So all of the things we've just been saying about reserving IOs, reserving latency, is custom made for companies like Fusion I.O. to shine. If you put Fusion I.O. in your data center, you can charge for these great latency characteristics. And I'm chomping at the bit to see those kinds of services available and have...
So you haven't seen any of those yet available through any kind of cloud provider yet?
There was one cloud provider who I can't remember the name of who did have SSDs, but it was in a very particular situation using
right.
Sun.
So some of the cloud providers are offering Memcached as a dial-up service in the package very simply, but that doesn't accomplish the same things that this card would accomplish.
Correct.
What would be the difference there, just so...
Well, one is a raw storage device.
Okay.
So, for example, if I was to go to Amazon to use the popular whipping boy and I wanted to say, hey, I want EBS, but I want this much EBS. I want 100,000 IOPS per second because I had a custom application.
Right, you can't
that
do
needed that.
You
much.
Can't do that.
You can't even
thousand.
Per second. That's about what this card does.
Damn.
Per second, every second. Read and write.
For reference, Amazon is currently at 100 on our largest.
Yeah.
The largest instance, you can get 100. So
100, not 100,000. 100. So yeah. So I mean, cards like this and SSDs are three orders of magnitude. Three orders of magnitude. That's a lot.
Yeah.
And in cloud deployments, I can't get there yet, and it pains me. But I think that what we've talked about regarding quality of service, APIs and specifications are what will allow customers to say, I want Fusion IO or some other SSD, because they're going to try to be able to specify 100,000 transactions per second. Mm-hmm. And I look forward to that day.
Yeah. Neat. Well, let's jump into the final section of the show, Cloud Tips. Anybody want to go first? I'll go first. My tip is Node.js. According to the Node website, the goal is to find an easy way to build scalable network programs. There's some neat things going on with Joyent and what they're doing with Node.js. So I haven't spent that much time looking at it and learning about it, but it does seem to be something worth investigating a little bit more, and maybe we'll get somebody who's got some more experience with Node.js on the show in the future. That is my cloud tip for this week. James, if you pick a VMware cloud tip, which you're welcome to, you have to pick a second one.
Sure. My VMware cloud tip would go out to Vertacore, who's a new partner in vCloud Express, which is something I work on.
Nice.
So that's kind of cool that Vertacore's here. They've talked to Vanessa. And then I guess my other cloud tip would be, I'd just like to thank the guys that were on the panel with me today. So three tips to Jay Clouds, who's obviously here, but also Engineard was on the panel and did a really good job, and in Stratus, George Reese. And the thing I realized when I was doing the panel is that these guys have been way out ahead of the curve. You know, like when we were just on a developer API, they're already working on it. So these are really people you can count on to kind of be your lighthouse in terms of where things are going, because they've been working on it long before 16,000 people knew about it.
Who was on the panel with you from EngineYard? Do you remember?
Edward Mahler.
Okay, great.
That was great.
Excellent. Adrian, do you have a cloud tip?
Sure. Were.
Can you spell that for us?
WHIRR. And it's a tool that's basically allows you to boot clusters and control them. So it's primarily developed by Tom White, who like wrote the Hadoop book in Cloudera. But it also has contributors from like Cassandra. And so it's basically like a tool to make it easy to run these big clusters. And currently it supports Hadoop, Zookeeper, and Cassandra. And it basically raises the level of abstraction from just like a bunch of, you know, virtual machines to a working cluster. And so I think it's important as we talk about how to normalize these APIs, because, you know, there's two problems: normalizing the API and normalizing the means to achieve it.
Right. Nice. Brian, is the Fusion IO card your tip of the week?
I wish it could be, because that would mean I could buy it somewhere on a cloud. But since I can't, I'm left high and dry there. I'd like to give a shout out to the guys at Makara. They do a product for cloud, easy cloud application launching. So they sniff... what they do is run what you brung, as I call it. You can take any PHP app, your regular LAMP stack, they instrument the kernel and allow you to to smoothly fire up instances and take them down. So I wish them a lot of luck.
A vCloud partner.
A vCloud partner.
And a friend of mine, their CTO.
And active developers on jClouds, and they're actually running our continuous integration.
I did want to give a shout out to AppDynamics. So they are a application performance startup looking across different infrastructure environments and looking across virtualization, cloud, and physical. I really like what they're doing. They are fairly new. They come from Wiley background, so CA owns Wiley now.
Yep.
And they have a refreshing view on what application performance should be. And so I really like them, and I look forward to seeing what they're doing.
Neat. Well, that is a wrap for this show. Let's do a quick roundabout for any web addresses or Twitter addresses that people want to give out so that listeners can contact them. James, we'll start with you.
WaterJames with two T's at Twitter.
Adrian?
At JClouds.
Vanessa?
At Vanessa Alvarez 1.
Brian?
At CitrusLeaf.
There you go. Gary Ornstein at Gary Ornstein. Also, we now have a cloud computing show Twitter address that's up and running, Cloud Show. And that's about it for today's show from VM World. Thanks very much to our listeners. Did you want to add anything else in, James, before we head out?
Nope, it's madness out there. Hope we all have fun.
Hope we all have fun. We hope to see people on the show floor. You can visit us at thecloudcomputingshow.com or email us at thecloudcomputingshow@gmail.com. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes by searching for The Cloud Computing Show or just clicking the top right link of our homepage. That'll take you to the iTunes subscription page. Thanks so much, everyone. We'll see you on the next show. Bye-bye.